Hey, good morning, everybody. So I get to introduce the next speaker. I don't know if he's sweating over this. Bill Cavanaugh is a professor of theology at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, and I didn't get to check with him. I think he's in professor of Catholic studies and at the teaching at the seminary and stuff too. No. Sorry, just in theology, we'll have to settle for that. He's author of some books that have been important to a lot of us, Torture and Eucharist, Theopolitical Imagination, and now Consuming Desire. He's also the only theologian I know, at least of my generation, who has an unofficial website dedicated to him. You didn't set that up yourself, Bill, did you? Have you seen it? It's a nice picture. Did somebody else here set that up, as a matter of fact? Okay, well, anyway. Bill Cavanaugh, here's the other thing I'll tell you about him, is proof that your mother was right. Just because you've gotten so smart now doesn't mean that you can't be nice to people. Bill is the nicest guy I know, in addition to about the smartest guy I know. So I'm very pleased to invite Bill to the stage, to the podium now.
Well, thanks for that introduction, Kelly. I guess now I have to scratch all the nasty things I was going to say about Michael Novak. Welcome, everybody. Let me get the technology straight here. Am I supposed to use both of these things at the same time? Or just one or the other?
Either the wireless or raise
them. Okay. Let's try that. Does that work? No. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right. Great. It's really fun to be back here. This is the funnest conference that I go to every year. It's an opportunity to meet old friends and make new friends, and it's a really kind of informal opportunity for an academic to exchange views with people who are not in academics, and those kind of boundaries don't get crossed a lot, so it's really a good opportunity. We went out, a bunch of us, last night for some refreshments at a bar close by, and it was right under the L track, and so we had to stop our conversation about every 5 minutes as the trains roared by, and somebody commented that this would be a really good thing to have in life, is just be forced to fall silent every 5 minutes or so. But I'm going to talk for about 40, 45, but I promise I'll be quiet after that. The economy is on everybody's mind these days. Somebody recently told me that he went to an ATM and the ATM asked him if he could borrow $20 until next week. But pastors and theologians and lay Christians are often reluctant to talk about it for a couple of seemingly contradictory reasons. On the one hand, we think that economics is too high above us, it's too esoteric, it's far beyond our expertise. And on the other hand, we're told that economics is about mundane material matters, whereas theology is about spiritual matters, God, the soul, and so on. And so in this version, it's theology that's esoteric and it floats above the merely material. And so for one reason or the other, or sometimes both, we pray for those who are hurt by the economic crisis, but we keep any kind of analysis of the problem to safe platitudes. If we look carefully at these reasons, however, I think we'll have reason to recover our courage. In the first place, it may be true that a lot of the current economic crisis is couched in esoteric terms that are difficult for non-specialists and even sometimes specialists to fully grasp. I certainly am no economist, and I find myself reluctant to wade into the waters of derivatives and hedge funds and credit default swaps and so on. But this complexity in esotericism is not a simple fact of nature. Financial instruments like credit default swaps were invented in part deliberately to keep certain forms of making money from public scrutiny. So the complexity of economics in such cases is not like the complexity of neurology or particle physics, where the complexity of the science corresponds to the complexity of the physical world. In the world of finance, many types of complexity are wholly fabricated. Many kinds of financial instruments have only the most tenuous relationship to the physical world. They're meant to make money not from any real physical productive activity, but from intangible beliefs and fears. Such financial instruments are a form of mystification. So there's nothing esoteric about economic activity as such. When an economy functions on a human scale, it's mundane and transparent to everybody. This brings us to the second reason that pastors and theologians and Christian laypeople often avoid talking about economic matters. Is it perhaps too mundane? Is Christianity not spiritual and therefore either transcending or irrelevant to economic matters? I think you can probably see the answer coming. The short answer is no, right? In fact, it's Christianity properly understood that's more grounded in material reality than much of what passes for economics in our current situation. I was asked specifically to focus this morning on the Christian doctrine of creation, so I'm going to explore how a true Christian understanding of creation gives us a basis for a theology rooted in material reality and an economic practice rooted in participation in God. So I'll begin by trying to explain and diagnose the current economic crisis, showing that the crisis is based in a fundamental inability to deal with reality. So much of what has gone wrong economically is precisely in the displacement of economic activity from the mundane and the material. I'll then examine the Christian doctrine of creation to suggest what a properly grounded view of material reality can contribute to our understanding of economics. And finally, I'll end with a few suggestions for how Christian communities can live this out. So, first section, the current crisis. Christians who face the current crisis with accusations of the age-old sin of greed are not wrong. There's plenty of covetousness for material goods driving the downfall. But I think that a deeper explanation moves in the opposite direction. The economic crisis is not driven by materialism, but by a desire to transcend the material world. There's a deeper desire than the desire for stuff apparent in the current crisis. If it's the desire to transcend the limits of the material world, to transcend the limits of the human body and of death, to be free from the scarcity and risk and dependence of a life that's materially based. There's no doubt that the buying and selling of things plays an important part in the global economy, but such things are incompletely described as material, for the economy is deeply imbued with fantasy. So let me begin by talking about the current economic crisis. Part of it is very easy to understand. Banks lent money to people who couldn't pay it back. Historically low interest rates and aggressive or predatory lending practices in the late 1990s and early 2000s led to a buying frenzy for houses. High-risk borrowers, people who could not qualify for loans in the past, were being sold on loans with no down payment required. It was a great deal for all involved as long as house values continued to rise. But the rise in house values was not based in any kind of extra financial reality. The rise was fueled by the loans themselves, which created demand for houses, thus driving housing prices up. So the story begins then at one significant remove from reality, because the rise was fueled by the loans themselves. But it gets worse. Banks know that they're in higher risk territory here, so they come up with financial instruments which they say help to reduce and disperse the risks, which is otherwise known as passing the risk on to somebody else. Thus begins what's known as securitization, which is the packaging of consumer debt, especially mortgages, for sale as investments to pension funds and individuals and banks and so on. These securities, which are called collateralized debt obligations, are marketed under the idea that in grouping mortgages together by the thousands, the good loans will outweigh the losses from the bad ones. They are given Moody's AAA ratings, and thus are high-risk, undesirable subprime mortgages repackaged and sold as safe investments. So we've achieved one more level of remove from reality. The idea of a banker actually sitting down at the local level with somebody in his or her community and assessing the real needs and resources of that person is now kind of quaint and anachronistic. But it gets worse. These collateralized debt obligations are listed by investment firms and hedge funds and banks as assets, and they're used as collateral for borrowing more money. Interest rates are so low they can borrow money cheaply and make investments with a much higher yield. So money is being made on borrowed money, and the money is being borrowed by using debt as collateral. Try that with your local bank. In traditional banking, you know, if you think Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life, people deposit money in the bank and then the bank lends that out to other people. But now banks and others were loaning out billions of dollars more than they actually had, and the relevant euphemism here is leveraging. But loans, even loans of money you don't actually have, are still rather mundane and pedestrian compared with some of the more exotic financial instruments that were marketed. With all those people in debt and so much resulting risk and insecurity, there must be a way of making money off the risk and the insecurity themselves. So, thus were born credit default swaps, which were invented by J.P. Morgan in 1995. Imagine that I lend Brent $100. Now, I'm a little concerned with Brent's ability to pay me back, so I write a contract with Tracy in which Tracy promises to pay me back my $100 if Brent defaults. And in exchange, I pay Tracy $10 a year. That's called a credit default swap. It's basically a form of insurance. I'm insuring the loan that I made to Brent. Now, the reason I need insurance on this loan, of course, is that I don't trust Brent, right? I'm willing to take risks on loaning money to unscrupulous or unstable parties like Brent because I can pass the risk off to someone else, Tracy, right? So credit default swaps, in other words, only encourage my risky behavior. Tracy, meanwhile, sees an opportunity to make money off the risk and my lack of trust. But, as you may by now have been ready to expect, it gets much worse than that. Because Phil sees this opportunity to make money off of risk and distrust, and he says, look, why should I have to be a party to the original loan to profit off of it, right? So he calls Kelly and says, hey, look, in exchange for $10 a year, he'll pay Kelly $100 if Brent defaults on my loan to him. Kelly, of course, is convinced that Brent will fail. And so she takes Phil up on the deal. So Brent and Tracy and I don't even know that Phil and Kelly are in on the action. So it's like taking out an insurance policy on someone else's house or car or life, somebody that you don't even know. Or a better analogy maybe is just going down to the off-track betting parlor and putting $20 down on a horse, right? Except it's worse than that. Because unlike with most forms of gambling, there is no government regulation of these swaps, and so they're limited only by the extent to which both parties are willing to wager. Congress passed a law in 2000, the brainchild of Senator Phil Gramm, specifically prohibiting federal and state regulation of credit default swaps and other derivatives. These are your elected representatives hard at work. The bill's sponsors were aware of the resemblance of such swaps to gambling, and so they inserted a clause in the bill that goes like this, saying that the bill, quote, would supersede and preempt the application of any state or local law that prohibits gaming, end quote. So did you catch that? It's just unbelievable. So they realize it looks an awful lot like gambling, so they exempt it from anti-gambling laws. Now, if Brent defaults on my loan to him, I would get $100 from Tracy. Now, depending, though, on how much money Kelly was willing and able to wager on Brent's failure, however, Kelly could collect millions or billions of dollars off of my loan to Brent, my $100 loan to Brent. The market in these swaps is enormous, but no one knows quite how enormous because they're unregulated and don't even need to be publicly disclosed. In fact, many parties don't even know who has the other side of their wager. Phil could sell his side of the bet to a third party without even telling Kelly. Estimates of the amount in outstanding credit default swaps vary, but in September of last year, Fortune magazine estimated $54.6 trillion, which, as Fortune pointed out, is more than the world's total annual economic output. So we're really reaching into unreality here, which is not bad considering they started at zero in 1995, right? Fortune explains their rapid rise this way, quote, "You can guess how Wall Street cowboys responded to the opportunity to make deals that, one, can be struck in a minute, two, require little or no cash up front, and three, can cover anything. Yeehaw, you can almost picture Slim Pickens and Dr. Strangelove climbing onto the H-bomb before it's released from the B-52. End quote. I think they're echoing Warren Buffett, who back in 2003 called credit default swaps economic weapons of mass destruction. And so, it would seem that financial traders have turned the world into one gigantic casino. But it's really much worse than that. Because at a casino, you could be reasonably sure that if you win at blackjack, the casino will have enough money to pay you your winnings, right? They have a cash reserve to back up its bets. No such reserve is legally required in the swaps market, which makes it different from the real insurance market. So anyone can bet anything in the swaps market if they can find someone willing to guess that they can cover their bet. The problem is that much more money is wagered than anyone actually has. Remember the more in the bets than the world's total economic output. So Tracy has guaranteed my loan to Brent, but Tracy has already spent the premiums or loaned them to someone else, and she has nothing to pay me back with if Brent defaults. She was banking on her assets in collateralized debt obligations, but now they are plummeting in value as high-risk borrowers begin to default on their mortgages and house values drop. When Tracy goes bankrupt, I'm in trouble with the credit ratings agencies who see that I have a lot of unprotected loans outstanding. So they lower my credit rating, which makes it harder for me to get credit. To make matters worse, I'm also up to my ears in the swaps market, insuring other people's debt. And so I go bankrupt, and now the whole house of cards begins to come down. But it's worse than just collapsing. Because since there's many bettors in the market, like Kelly, who are betting on defaults, there's actually an incentive for many players like Kelly to hasten the demise of companies by publicizing their problems and driving up the costs of insuring their debt by trading their credit default swaps contracts. So people have incentive to make it worse. On the other side, the government is trying to stabilize the situation by bailing out the most reckless of players. AIG had written $78 billion worth of swaps based on money it didn't actually have. The government steps in to bail out a system it had deliberately refused to negotiate, to regulate. The high-risk world of corporate finance thus turns out not to be so high-risk after all, because the government ends up covering all the lousy bets that AIG and others made. Where is the government getting the money? They're borrowing it, of course, right? In enormous quantities. So, end of the first part of the talk. Second part on the spirituality of economics. If you're like me, you're feeling a little queasy after this. Sorry to have ruined your breakfast. But when I think about these matters, I get the same sort of feeling that I get when I'm kind of looking down from a great height, like peering over the Grand Canyon rim or looking down from an airplane or what I would imagine it's like, you know, if you're on a tightrope walking between two tall buildings and you kind of look down and see someone arranging pillows on the sidewalk below. What's happened is that the economy has gotten detached from reality. There's so much leveraging going on. which is basically trying to build assets out of debt, which is to say, out of nothing at all. This creatio ex nihilo is built entirely on perception, and as in any pyramid scheme, it can be kept going only as long as the perception of growth is maintained, and when this perception is burst, the fall from unreality to reality can be very painful, wreaking havoc in the real world, all sorts of people thrown out of their real world jobs because of this. The Pope Benedict XVI said back in October, "We are now seeing in the collapse of major banks that money vanishes. It is nothing. All these things that appear to be real are in fact secondary. Only God's words are a solid reality." If there's a theme to this talk, I think that's pretty much it. In order to see how theology can help in such a situation, it's important to grasp the prevailing economic paradigm as a kind of spirituality. What's important in all of the preceding discussion of the current crisis is not just the underlying theme of greed for material things, but the way in which the dominant paradigm takes flight from the material world. The aspiration of such an economy is not just to make money. The deeper aspiration, I think, is to leave behind physical constraints and limits that are created by being mortal creatures in space and time. Let me talk about that under three headings, three kinds of limits that it tries to overcome. The first limit, scarcity. Scarcity is said to be a central problematic for the discipline of economics. It's based on the idea of unlimited desires facing limited resources. For classical economists, economics will always be tragic because there's never enough to satisfy all possible human wants. The infinite nature of human want is constrained by the finite nature of material resources. But the financialization of the economy, as it's been called, can be seen as an attempt to overcome the limits of the material world by making wealth multiply without any real increase in real material production. Economists have been worried since the end in the 1970s of the post-war capitalist boom that growth and profitability are stagnated because of overproduction, the high price of oil, and the physical limits on growth that ecological reality has imposed. So financialization has been seen as an escape route, as Walden Bellow says, an attempt to make money out of nothing when the real material economy runs up against its limit. Much of the growth in the economy has been in the financial sector, but it's not real growth. It creates profit, but not real value. Profit depends on getting in, profit for some, that is, of course, and disaster for others. Right? Profit depends on getting in early on these speculative bubbles and then passing the risk off to someone else before it pops. Financialization can be understood as an attempt to transcend the limits of material reality, to create ex nihilo. We have been sold on the imperative of economic growth at all costs. Such faith in growth is not just a material, but a spiritual aspiration, an attempt to get beyond our damnable servitude to material reality and overcome the limits of human vulnerability. The second thing that it tries to overcome is risk. At first glance, you might think that this type of economy embraces risk and vulnerability. There is certainly a recklessness to it, and the system as a whole is fraught with danger and insecurity. But in fact, as we've seen, the crisis was built on the attempt to defer risk and to pass it along to someone else. There's certainly an attempt to profit from risk and vulnerability in this economy. So high-risk borrowers were given loans with few safeguards. But securitization was precisely the attempt to pass the risk along to someone else. There was no attempt, as in some forms of lending, to enter into a relationship of shared risk between lender and borrower. The whole point was short-term profit and the quick passing off of loans to others before the true risks became apparent. The system is based on the fantasy that people can be free of vulnerability and shared risk, that profit can be made risk-free. The government, of course, helps to perpetuate this fantasy. The government's role in the crisis, I think this is important to understand, is to absorb risk, to bail out the most reckless with borrowed money, which is only to defer the consequences of risk to some later time. What we seem to want from our elected politicians is to permit us to continue avoiding reality for as long as possible, to live on value borrowed from the future. And to live on value borrowed from the future is most fundamentally an attempt to cheat death. The third limit that is overcome, or is attempted to be overcome, is the necessity of trust. As we've seen, the economic crisis was not built simply on a failure of trust, but more fundamentally on the attempt to overcome the necessity of trust. The reason that loans needed to be insured is that they were made between parties who lacked a basic sense of trust in each other. Any idea that loans depend on some kind of relationship and trust over time is gone with this model. Money can be made much more quickly if the necessity of trust is done away with. More than this, profit can be made from distrust itself by offering to guarantee loans between mutually suspicious parties. Even more than this, money can be made in the swaps market from other people's failures. Not only is it unnecessary to trust in another's ability to succeed, but one can actively root for and even abet the other's failure and profit from it. From a spiritual point of view, what we see in this is an aspiration to freedom, understood negatively as freedom from obligation to others. The kind of relationships of dependence that limit human freedom, the necessity of community and reliance upon others, the stasis of an economy restricted to local face-to-face encounters, these are seen as outmoded remnants of the economies of traditional societies and have no place in the contemporary economy. Independence and the ability to transcend the merely local are valued for their liberating dynamism. Now, I've concentrated on the current crisis of financialization, but these Gnostic tendencies have been aspirations of the prevailing economic system for much of the 20th century. Consumerism is famously prone to fantasy, most obviously in marketers' mostly successful attempts to associate mundane products with transcendent qualities like independence and status and sexual ecstasy and youth and freedom from necessity and so on. Right, so the advertisement for sun-kissed orange sodas, all these kind of babes and studs frolicking on the beach and so on. And then you buy the can, and what you get is fizzy orange liquid. You know, you're still stuck in Minnesota in the day. purely hypothetical example. Retirement ads, sail away on your yacht and all that kind of stuff, right? The modern American dream house is really, I think, precisely so-called because it's not so much a material thing, but a marvel of transcendence of the material. Water and heat and cooling and communication and information and entertainment all appear at the touch of a button, and waste, enormous quantities of it, just magically disappears. The ecological consequences of this type of life are hidden and excluded from the prices that we pay. Products simply appear on store shelves for our consumption without having to labor to produce them or even to know who produces them and how. Globalization has long since removed actual material production from our sight and located it in some spectral periphery of happy poor people who are just grateful to have jobs. Right? Transnational corporations not only seek to transcend the local, shifting from place to place in search of the cheapest labor and the most lax environmental laws. As Naomi Klein says, they also seek to transcend the material world, to concentrate on brand management while leaving the loathsomely corporeal process of manufacturing to subcontractors. So, third part, creation. What does the Christian doctrine of creation have to say about these aspirations? Let's begin by recognizing two basic features of Christian thinking on creation. First, material reality is good. Second, material reality is limited. Both of these truths issue logically from the fact of creation. Creation has some share in the goodness of God by virtue of the fact that it relies upon the being of God for its being. If God is all good, then the creation of God must also be good. God declares it to be so, of course, over and over in Genesis 1. And yet, precisely because creation is created, it is not creator. It occupies a place on the far side of a yawning gap between creator and creation. So creator and creation are not on a continuum of being, the latter emanating from the former. They are entirely different, wholly other to each other as cause and caused. Creation is limited by virtue of being created. The Christian doctrine of creation, therefore, approaches material reality with realism and humility, a recognition of the limited and dependent nature of creation. At the same time, however, because it also recognizes that creation is good, there is no need to try to transcend reality and try to escape our creatureliness. To be a creature of a good God is a condition to rejoice in and not rebel against. Finitude, then, is not a condition from which we need to be saved, because creation is not a falling away from God. The creation of something besides God is the beginning of a great, if tempestuous, love story, an erotic attraction of creator and creature. Creation is not, erotic in the sense of desire, not... you get the idea, right? Creation is not a one-time event, but a continuous and intimate sustaining of the creature and being. Thomas Aquinas stressed the absolute ontological divide between creator and creature, right? God is not a thing in the universe, but is the sheer act of existence itself. Yet precisely because they don't compete for space, as it were, on the same level, the creator and creature share the deepest intimacy. Because God must constantly cause being in each creature, and because being is innermost in each thing, Aquinas reasons that God is in all things and innermostly. That's one of my favorite quotes from Aquinas. Creation produces both the greatest divide and the greatest intimacy between creator and creatures. And creatures here means not just human beings, but every material thing that has being. Christians are often, so everything, like this and beer and your garden and whatever. Christians are often puzzled or bored or indifferent when confronted by the Torah's obsessive concern with regulating every aspect of Israelite life. You know, those of you who preach on Sunday know how hard it is to preach on some of those things. Does the Holy Book really need to tell us what to do when one ox gores another? You know, or why are bald eagles detestable to eat, but bald locusts are okie dokie? Right. That's Leviticus 11. If you want to look that up, I have no idea what a bald locust is, and I'm not sure I would want to eat a hairy one either. Anyway. So there's probably some details of these passages that need sorting out, but the main point is not to be missed, right? The Old Testament writers had an abiding concern with the materiality of life, right? There simply was no distinction between spiritual concerns and material concerns. The realm of the material is not just a kind of inert and indifferent means to the spiritual aspirations of our lives. The salvation of the whole community is worked out not in some interior dialogue with God, me and Jesus, but in the everyday interactions with the material world. And all of creation is to be brought into conformity with God's will. And so all of the old stereotypes about how, you know, Jews are material, but Christians are spiritual, as if this was some sort of achievement that we have kind of gotten away from gross material reality. All of that, I think, is poisonous. We really need to appreciate the materiality of the Old Testament. Ellen Davis has this wonderful new book called Scripture, Culture, and Agriculture. It's an agrarian reading of the Old Testament, and she shows how the law codes in the Old Testament, which unfortunately are neglected usually by Christians, are meant to habituate a deep awareness of and rootedness in one's physical surroundings. The land, the trees, the birds, and the animals are all meant to fit within this harmonious order willed by God. And so work and eating and worship and sex and even what to do with one's waste are all linked together in such a way that the life of the community with God is meant to fit into the actual physical landscape that we inhabit. So there's no divide between spiritual and economic matters, and the biblical writers would have found any such divide to be unthinkable or perverse. They recognize that there's a spirituality embedded in all kinds of economic practice, whether we acknowledge it or not. According to Davis, there's no dichotomy in the law codes between the merely symbolic and the ethical. She argues that Leviticus 11, for example, in Leviticus 11, the overall effect of the restrictions on animal bloodshed and the careful and painless methods of slaughter is to show God's compassion for all creatures. And so humans are to mirror that compassion by keeping God's good order and care for creation. In the priestly theology of Leviticus 11, we see the beginnings of an ecological doctrine, she argues. The dietary instructions there carefully echo the priestly creation account in Genesis 1, thus linking dietary laws with the ongoing concern for creation. The dietary instructions in Leviticus 11 also climax in a reminder of the covenant of God's bringing the Israelites up out of Egypt. Faithfulness to creation and covenant is inculcated in the very specific kinds of attention and care that humans pay to the mundane acts of raising animals and eating. She contrasts this with, she has a long account of how meat gets on your table, and doesn't make for very pleasant reading. She gets most of it from Michael Pollan, if any of you have read about the meat industry. For Christians, the erotic unity of God and material creation is affirmed in Jesus Christ. There's no dichotomy there between Old and New Testament. As Karl Barth argues, we don't begin with the reality of the physical world and then deduce that there must have been a creator. Because for him, he says, there's nothing given about the material world. There's lots of people like Gnostics and Hindus who look out at the world and see creation is nothing but a veil of Maya, is a kind of veil of unreality. Barth says that we only know the reality of the material world through Jesus Christ, whose reality affirms that God does not want to exist alone. As Barth says, quote, creation is the temporal analog taking place outside God of that event in God himself by which God is the Father of the Son, end quote. So the covenant which comes to fruition in the incarnation of the Son is the ultimate proof of the reality of the material world, for God has chosen through Jesus Christ to bring into one the creator and the creature. Another quote from Barth, because God has become man, the existence of creation can no longer be doubted. Here Barth is following the path blazed by Irenaeus in his controversies with Valentinus and Marcion. The Gnostics' extreme pessimism about material reality caused them to posit a dualism between the supreme God, the God of Jesus Christ, who is responsible for the invisible spiritual universe, and a lesser God or a demiurge identified with the God of the Old Testament, who is responsible for creation, which is a pretty bad idea to begin with, creation was. Irenaeus strongly reaffirms the doctrine of the incarnation and thereby affirmed the unity between the God of creation and the God of Jesus Christ. Against the docetic tendencies of the Gnostics, who could not affirm that Jesus Christ did indeed take on loathsome human flesh, Irenaeus argues that the Word was made flesh, quote, which had been derived from the earth, which he had recapitulated in himself, bearing salvation to his own handiwork, end quote. Irenaeus thus links creation and salvation, affirming at once the goodness of creation, which came through Jesus Christ the Word, and the final consummation of that creation in the union of the one true God and material creation in the incarnation. Irenaeus finds harmony between what Ellen Davis calls the materialism of the Old Testament and the central conviction of the New Testament that Jesus Christ is the Word of God made flesh. If the Christian tradition from its Jewish roots to its consummation in Jesus Christ is materialistic, it's a different kind of materialism than what we usually refer to as materialism, right? Biblical materialism doesn't insist that the material as we know it is all there is, but that we are limited by being mortal material creatures in space and time, and we must therefore approach material reality with an attitude of humility. Modern scientific materialism, on the other hand, is the dangerous illusion that all is reducible to the merely material and that science can eventually overcome any limits that the merely material might put in our way. Davis calls this a kind of magical thinking. Quote, "For despite its ostensible grounding in science, this form of materialism is strangely oblivious to what may be the most readily observable and non-negotiable characteristic of our material world, namely finitude." That's a great quote. Despite its ostensible grounding in science, this form of materialism is strangely oblivious to what may be the most readily observable and non-negotiable characteristic of our material world, namely finitude. When you stub your toe, the reality of this just kind of comes home to you. We come then to the second important characteristic of the doctrine of creation. Material reality, though good, is limited. It's clear from the first creation account in Genesis that all that is dependent upon God for its existence. Humans are situated, so I talked first about the goodness of creation, now the limitedness. Humans are situated within this ordering of creation and not above it, though being made in God's image does infer a kind of, or confer a kind of unique status on humans. But humans are made in God's image. Only Jesus Christ is the image of God and therefore creator, as Colossians says. The image of God is not a quality inherent in human nature. The image of God in humanity can be damaged or obscured while basic human capacities remain. The image of God, therefore, is a relational concept. Bearing the image of God means being in right relationship with God and with the rest of creation, to know the Creator and to know ourselves as creatures. But as Davis points out, the relation is not just between humans and God. Humans are enmeshed in a whole web of relationships with the rest of creation that have their origin in God. Humans do not simply stand over the rest of creation in a God-humans-creation hierarchy. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer and many others have noted, the earth in Genesis 1 is a major actor, second only to God. Right? Let the earth bring forth, and so on. God's gift to humans of dominion over the critters of the earth is often taken as license to transcend the earth, to stand above it as one who dominates and exploits. But ownership of the land belongs to God and is never to be appropriated for private use, as God makes plain in Leviticus 25:23, "The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. With me, you are but aliens and tenants." That's a great thing to remember, especially with regard to mortgages. The implication that humans transcend the land is also contradicted by the creation of humans in Genesis 2 from the dust of the ground. Humans are part of the earth and do not stand apart from it. Davis shows how the verbs in Genesis 2:15, commonly translated to till and to keep the garden, can be translated to serve and to observe. Humans are to protect and preserve the land as well as learn from it. For our knowledge is finite and must be attuned to our actual material surroundings in order to be in right relationship with the earth and with God. As Davis comments, quote, "Adam comes to Eden as a protector, answerable for the well-being of the precious thing that he did not make. He is to be an observer, mindful of limits that are built into the created order as both inescapable and fitting." The biblical writer does not subscribe to the fantasy that our society has embraced as an ideal, that human ingenuity runs up against physical limits only to overcome them. End quote. The finite nature of the earth is not just a result of the fall when Adam is told that the ground is cursed because of him. Indeed, it may be the case that the curse is simply a consequence of Adam's attempt to ignore or defy the limits imposed by material reality. The ground is cursed only insofar as Adam refuses to accept his own finite existence and his own place in the order of creation. The cause of the fall, after all, is the human refusal to accept the limit established pre-fall by the prohibition on eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The very heart of sin is the temptation to be like God, to attempt to deny the limited nature of human existence and cross the divide between creator and creature. The fall, in other words, is not the fall of humanity into finiteness. The fall is precisely the refusal of humans to accept finite existence as good. At the root of all sin is the attempt to avoid reality. Thomas Merton said something like that somewhere. I tried to find it, but couldn't. The root of all sin is the attempt to avoid reality. Now, it's of course the Christian hope and assurance that death won't have it the final word, and a share in eternal life will be ours. But salvation in Christ is not simply the overcoming of the limits of human existence, especially death. Christ's triumph is a triumph through the cross, an invitation to new life that begins by death to the self. The grain of wheat must fall into the ground and die to have eternal life. To be saved by Christ is to be joined to the suffering body of Christ. We do overcome death, but only insofar as the limits of the small self are overcome in dependence on God and on one another. The limits of the self are overcome by accepting membership in a body where, as Paul says, weakness is clothed with honor and all suffer and rejoice together. As Thomas Merton writes about the coming of Christ, quote, "The secret of the Advent mystery is then the awareness that I begin where I end, because Christ begins where I end. In more familiar terms, I live to Christ when I die to myself. I begin to live to Christ when I come to the end or to the limit of what divides me from my fellow man." End quote. To speak positively of limits, then, of scarcity and mutual dependence and shared risk and trust, is not to resign oneself to a tragically faulty creation, to accept that not only do we have a jealous God, but we have a stingy one too. Jesus came that we may have life and have it abundantly. But Jesus talks about abundant life in the context of the sheepfold of which he's shepherd. To live abundantly is not to cut oneself off from relationship with the sheep and the shepherd and the land, to indulge in fantasies of freedom from the care of others and limitless material satisfaction without consequences. Abundant life is accepting the shepherd's love and living in nurturing relationship with all of creation. Just a few closing comments. I want to stop so we can talk. If we're to practice an economy that embraces both the goodness and the limits of creation, then we have to be grounded. If we see ourselves as made from God's breath and the dust of the ground, then we will see ourselves and the material creation as invested with cosmic significance. Our work will be more than an instrumental relationship with the material, more than a means to give flight to our spirits away from this tragically limited, dependent mortal life. It will be a way of blessing the creation of which God has made us part. A lot of responses to the current economic crisis have advocated a greater role for the state in regulating markets. That's usually where these kinds of analyses end. The state has to step in and regulate. While I acknowledge that some forms of state intervention might be useful to prevent some of the worst types of abuse, I don't think that we should put too much faith in the state to save us. The interests of the state and corporation have become too closely intertwined to expect the state to rein in the corporation. And that's really not what the state does. The state has instead taken on the role of enabler. The state is there to pick up the pieces when reckless market behavior leads to disastrous consequences. So people don't so much look to the state to defend them against corporate power. They look to the state to defer the consequences of a sick economy to some future time. As Wendell Berry has written, we should not expect someone else, the state or the corporation, to solve the problem, because the problem begins with the fact that we have already given proxies for almost all of our economic and political practices to them. We have given proxies to corporations to produce all our food, clothing, and shelter, and are rapidly giving proxies to corporations and the state to provide education, healthcare, childcare, and all sorts of basic human services that local communities used to provide. As Barry says, quote, "Our major economic practice, in short, is to delegate the practice to others," end quote. So solutions are not likely to come from governments and corporations, but from ourselves. People must heal economic practices by bringing them back down to earth, giving local communities a direct involvement in discerning what's necessary for the health of the community. This means acknowledging dependence on one another and sharing risk. It means being attentive to local forms of knowledge of people and land. It means reestablishing direct face-to-face relationships between producers and consumers, as well as encouraging everyone to become producers of something, right? Gardening, baking bread, making beer, making furniture, whatever it might be. I make my own beer, so that's why I mentioned that. To reconnect with the material world and not just to be passive consumers. It would be hard to exaggerate the difference between the way most of human beings have lived throughout most of history, where the stuff we had was stuff that we made, and now almost all of the stuff we have is stuff that we bought. That's a very different way of relating to the material world that things need to be healed. We need to stop giving our money over to an abstract and destructive financial system and put it to work locally through credit unions and co-ops that can make realistic and cooperative assessments of debt and risk. Churches are taking leading roles in this, and I think we're going to hear more about that later, about creating these kinds of local economies and fostering these kinds of local economies. But this is not just a matter of what can the churches do to help out in creating these other kinds of economies. It's really a matter of being faithful to the gospel, and that's the note that I want to end on. It's not just a matter of contributing to an economic reality from the religious sphere. It's really a matter of healing the way that we relate to creation and the way that we live out the gospel. How Christians relate to the material world is not a tangential or optional issue, but it's at the very heart of practicing the Christian doctrines of creation and incarnation. And it's a joyful thing. Wendell Berry has this wonderful essay called "The Joy of Sales Resistance." And so I think it's in some ways an imperative of living out the joy of the gospel and the joy of the creation. So I'm going to stop there. Thanks.
Okay, we'll take about 10 minutes of roundtable conversation and reflection on Bill's talk, economics and the doctrine of creation. And then Bill, come back up and we'll do some question and answer time. All righty? So, stir each other up. Okay, it's about time to start wrapping up the conversations, and we'll get Bill back up here. Okay, we'll do this like yesterday, hands up, and there's folks with the mics. When you're asking your question or making your comment, if you could stand up, that would be helpful for the rest of the room. And, okay, Bill.
Well, Kent McDougall just told me that the EP planned this topic like 3 years ago before any of us knew that things were going to collapse. So we were wondering if whoever was responsible for that could pick us some stocks or something. Have some kind of prescient knowledge of what's going on.
Or horses.
There you go. So, comments, questions?
Thank you so much for
autonomy that's tied to the earth. And I hear that proposal. I'm struck, though, here, when I'm reading the Larry, likewise, I'm struck by how conservative that sounds in our political conversation. That sounds a lot like Marvin Alasky said, and what Newt Gingrich took to his Congress and got a whole bunch of people to cut welfare because the church can take care of it in the local community. And a constant challenge in my life is I try to figure out how we can have a local economy in a little neighborhood in Durham. I also have a friend who's the president of the NAACP, and he keeps calling me and saying, listen, this whole economy was built on the backs of the folks in your neighborhood who did the work for free, and you got to advocate some kind of distribution beyond your local community. So I'm curious to hear, because your analysis is so good, I'd like to hear from you how we can advocate from the local economy for some sort of larger redistribution.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think there is no sense in kind of fetishizing the local community, because local communities in and of themselves can be bad, too. And there isn't a sense in which we should kind of close the gates around us and not be concerned about people elsewhere. The important point of local, I think, is personal contact and face-to-face. It's kind of knowing who you're dealing with and how you're dealing with them. And that can take place globally as well. I mean, part of the fair trade movement is an attempt to do that beyond the confines of our small local communities and establish relationships with people who may be on the other side of the globe, but in such a way where we know each other in some way, and technology helps with that, where you can see in some sense the people that are producing your stuff, where you can ensure in some way that they're getting a fair price and a price that sustains them in their life for those kinds of things. So I think there are all kinds of trans-local networks that need to be created as well as just concentration on the local. What I'm wary of, though, is the state being the kind of default measure for these kinds of trans-local activities, because wherever that happens, it almost inevitably gets sucked back into the same kind of paradigm of this sort of where the universal and the powerful triumphs over the local and the particular and the weak. And so when Newt Gingrich talks about cutting government spending, of course, he's not talking about the Pentagon. And, he's talking about cutting kind of safety nets for people. And I don't necessarily think that's a good thing. Maybe that's a goal to wean people off of welfare, but it's not a means to simply cut the rug out from under them. There's so much of the assumption is that there's basically just two actors. There's the corporation and there's the state. And if the corporation is screwing us, then all we can do is go to the state and ask for help. And the assumption that those are two kind of opposed entities, I think, is a deeply flawed assumption, because really the reality of it is they're so closely intertwined anymore that it's hard to it's hard to extract them. And what the state has done in this current sort of bailout is just cushion the blow and make the consequences of the recklessness of corporations less apparent to us. But it's just kind of deferring the consequences. That seems to be what we want from our elections. I think your point is very well taken. These kind of cross-local, trans-local networks are also very important besides the local action.
Yeah. Section
that I where I kind of nuanced the talk about scarcity and so on that I didn't read just because we're running short on time. Steve Long and other people talk about the notion of scarcity in a way it functions in economics as a kind of ideology, and that sort of scarcity is based on the idea that there are limited resources and unlimited desires, and so you have infinite desires for finite resources. And the problem with that is not that resources aren't really finite. You do live in a finite world. The problem is the attachment of infinite desires to finite things. And so what we need to do is attach infinite desires to the only thing that's infinite, which is God. And so that's the problem of that sort of paradigm of scarcity. But there's another sense in which scarcity and limits is just a fact of the material world. But the way that fits into this kind of abundant life, I tried to sort of hint at that by quoting John 10:10, talking about the sheepfold, and the quote from Thomas Merton, I think, that kind of gets at that as well, is that you run up to the limits of the self only to kind of broaden that out and into a much larger kind of reality, the kind of magna awning, the sort of great soul, where you participate in the body of Christ, in this kind of body of superabundance in that sense. But it's a superabundance in which we all rejoice together and we all weep together and care for the weakest amongst us. And that, I think, is the kind of abundance in which you can then be free. I mean, and just to put it on a real kind of concrete level, there's a real sort of superabundance then in being able to relax and being able to count on your dependence on others. I mean, part of the way the paradigm works is that now we couldn't possibly live with our children or live with other people when we retire. This is just unthinkable. And so we all need to build up enormous war chests of money for our retirement because we have to kind of be independent. And there's never going to be enough of that. And so abundance, then, what abundance means is not bigger retirement accounts for everybody, but abundance is rather being able to relax about that and saying, when I retire, there's all these people that I'm going to be able to live with, and we all kind of provide for one another, and then you can just sort of relax and think, I don't care what the stock market does, you know. Can be a burden to my children and so on. However that's going to work out. But the anxieties that we have about independence, I think, really come across in these sorts of ideas. And so the abundant life is then the life that's shared amongst all, where there's always enough. Yeah. Brian.
Drawing on Aquinas, Dante,
any thoughts on, he was talking about how in Dante's hell, some very terrible people, I can't remember who it was.
The blasphemers, the sodomites, and the usurers are all in the circle of violence.
The blasphemers, sodomites, and usurers are all in the same circle. Any thoughts about usury, the prohibition of usury? I don't know enough about the history of the prohibition against usury. I know that there were ways of getting around it in the Middle Ages that were had to do with the kind of fruit. What's the word? Lucrum? Yeah, is that it? I can't remember. But Steve Long makes an argument about this that it all has to do with
There are ways of kind of getting around the prohibition of usury as long as the money is kind of put to work within a kind of communal context. And that seems to me to be, I mean, there are some, like Dorothy Day, who denied any kind of interest at all and once returned a check to the city of New York because it contained, part of it was money that was interest paid on that money. But I think there are other ways of dealing with interest. Part of my retirement account is in the self-help credit union in Durham, North Carolina. And the model that they operate on, which has been very successful, is dealing with low-income and minority people, businesses, and homes. And they take the money that's actually in the bank, the deposits, and loan it out in a real sustainable way in which people can pay back and start businesses and gain homes and so on. So I don't buy a kind of prohibition, a complete prohibition of interest in that way. But I do think that what needs to be considered in any of these kinds of operations where you're trying to make money from money is the kind of real world effects on it. I mean, it's interesting that there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about the way credit unions have weathered the crisis, the economic crisis, and they're much better off than some of the banks that were into these kind of exotic financial instruments, because the sort of economy that they're dealing with is much more local, it's much more face-to-face, it's much lower to the ground. They're actually lending out money than they actually have, and working with people and assessing needs and resources in a real kind of concrete way. And so that's about the best that I can do on that score. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Wendell Berry is fond of saying things like abstraction inevitably leads to abuse. And that idea is kind of at the heart of this whole critique of technology and industrial economics and all that stuff. And as you keep saying, you know, well, it gets worse. And then you name another way that what led up to the financial crisis was, you know, continuing ways to abstract the making of money from anything of actual value. I had this little nagging buzz in the back of my head saying, well, what about, you know, the basis of the banking system as a whole, the fractional reserve system, and the basing of money's value on essentially constructs based on debt from the very get-go. You know, money that is created by the making of loans, which then have to be paid back at interest, which requires creation of new money, which requires new, and you know, so on and so forth. And it seems to me that the pathology goes, you know, all the way, it tunnels all the way down, as it were.
It does.
And at what point do we need to say whose inscription is on this coin, and how can we, you know, go on dealing with this reality that the system is rotten to the core, while also dealing with the fact that, you know, my wife and I will have to make a rent payment at the beginning of next month and deal with the, you know, the reality of this world, even though it is abstracted from actual value.
Right. Once you've created a money economy, you're already at one level of abstraction from reality. And that's, everybody heard the points. And you're absolutely right. Once you've created a money economy, then you're already at a remove of reality where this little piece of paper can magically be transformed into something real. It can be transformed into food, for example. That's a kind of mystical, you know, Marx talked a lot about the kind of mystical quality of that. And if you get another one, it only has a one on it or something, that you can get less food for it and so on. Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. And there are some attempts now to get beyond money economies. I mean, one of the idea of kind of skill banks that are used on a local level is one way of getting out of the economy. I mean, one of the real concrete effects of the money economy is oftentimes that you could have a refrigerator repairman and an auto mechanic living next to each other. The auto mechanic's fridge is broken and the fridge mechanic's car is broken, and they can't do anything about it because they're both out of work and they don't have money, right? And so skill banks are attempts to create a kind of economy where you don't have to rely on money, because money in that sense is keeping them apart. And if they can repair each other's fridge and car, then you've got an economy which isn't based on this abstraction of money. And you try to expand that out by everybody kind of using their bankable skills for script in a way that they can then cash in for somebody else to do something. So I can make beer for somebody and somebody can make bread for me, and no money needs to change hands. That's, in some ways, a sort of ideal, and any of those sorts of attempts to get away from a money economy, I think, are very laudable. We're so far from that situation now that I think if we can just kind of bring the level of abstraction down to where money more or less resembles kind of reality, then we'll be doing great. But I think you're absolutely right. Ultimately, in some sense, it's the goal is to do away with those kinds of abstraction altogether.
So this is a great conversation, and there are hands up all over the room, and we've probably only got time for maybe one more question. So Alan here is going to ask something, and then Bill, if you'll be gracious enough to be hanging around over the next while, maybe some other people have chances to talk.
Yeah, sure.
Would you recommend that local congregations and parishes consider systems of mutual aid and distribution of local economy sort of built out of the relational base of those bodies?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of different models for how to do that. My congregation is part of a co-op of small organic farmers in Minnesota that markets through the churches. And so you've kind of eliminated middlemen and created a direct relationship with the farmers. That's one way in which the kind of concrete relationships that are formed in the community can help to create these sorts of economies. I'm sure that there's probably plenty of other examples of how to do that. But the first thing that needs to happen, I think, is people being able to talk within their congregations about money. And that's something that oftentimes just doesn't even begin to happen. You know, you might hear a rumor that someone is unemployed, and everybody says, gee, isn't that bad? And you pray for all of the unemployed in general the next Sunday. But we just don't talk about money with one another. If we can begin talking about money, then we can begin talking about kind of cooperative relationships that might begin to address some of those issues.
Let me take a coordinator's prerogative to tell first, Bill, you're not off the hook yet. Don't breathe your sigh of relief. The way the schedule works, we can do another 10 minutes of questions, and then we'll move the first workshops back 15 minutes. So workshops will be 10:45 to noon. That'll still give you a full hour for lunch and another 30-minute break with the afternoon workshop session starting as scheduled at 1:30 to 2:45. Given that, Kelly's already identified, I don't know, three or four people who are still trying to get in on questions. So we'll do another 10 minutes of discussion here, all right?
At the risk of coming across as irrelevant as possible, as it's possible to do, when the Wendell Berry keeps coming up and all these kind of conversations, and I'm a fan, but it seems to me that Wendell reluctantly goes to the Amish as an example. And I'm wondering if a community that's that disciplined that does engage, but engages as a community with community-based decisions, is something that we don't look at seriously enough, and we don't take that sort of discipline as a responsibility for traditional faith-based communities.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the Amish are oftentimes trotted out as a kind of conversation stopper, you know, a kind of reductio ad absurdum. You know, you start talking about these matters and you say, well, what are you going to do, be Amish then? You know, are you going to trade in your car for a buggy and so on? And that's the end of the conversation. So we tend to shy away from the Amish. But yeah, I mean, there's so much to learn from the Amish without actually becoming Amish. And who knows, maybe that's what we're all called to do, is become Amish. I don't know. I mean, we'll see. I don't want to discount that either in some ways. But I don't think that it needs to be an either or in that way. All of these matters are matters that are resolved on a case-to-case basis. And one of the things that's interesting about the Amish is that the Amish themselves do that. You know, that there are Amish communities with telephones and so on, but they might decide that rather than have a telephone in each of our houses, which would be wasteful and distracting, let's have a telephone for every few houses and have a public telephone booth on a certain road where we can have access to a telephone when we need one, but there's nobody that's going to be calling us in the middle of dinner asking us if we want aluminum siding. And so all of these matters can be, there isn't a kind of black and white. All of these matters are negotiated on a case-to-case basis. And I think there's a lot to learn from the Amish.
For what it's worth, I just thought I'd offer a medical prescription for what I've experienced talking about this with friends. For what it's worth, I'll just offer a medical describes how a lot of people come to these sorts of conversations in my experience, and that's that especially in gatherings like this where we're basically like mine and we're looking for leadership in the gospel, I think we're a lot like Peter and during Jesus' ministry saying, you know, you're the Messiah, you're the Savior, etc., etc. And then and you know, Peter had a very particular idea of what the Messiah would look like. And for us, I think we talk about abundance, and you know, abundance sounds so great. But then Jesus leads us to the cross, and we're all called like Peter, and we just say, "Oh, that's what you meant." And that's abundance. So I think what we miss in a lot of these conversations is Jonathan talked about Jesus' ministry being, you know, tactical when we're living among the Romans, how we still insert some resistance. And what we miss in these conversations sometimes is the sort of idea of disciplines that are going to break the power of money. We wind up talking a lot about money and how to use money and things like this instead of, I don't know, maybe talking about how to use our time. And in our community, we've made corporate prayer daily an emphasis. And so when you submit your time to meeting at the church twice a day to pray, you do things like come in contact with homeless people and all this other stuff. So just from that point of view, I mean, I think there's a point where in all of these conversations about abundance, we're going to be led to the cross, and then we're going to have to deal with despair.
That's good. I like what you said, that the cross is abundance. You know, that it isn't that kind of choice between either the cross or abundance in some sense. It's just a redefinition of what we mean by abundance. You know, it's what Christ says to the rich young man, go and sell all you have, poor. And the rich young man says, you know, hey, there's not something else I can do. He doesn't realize that what Christ is calling him to is in fact abundance. And he sort of disciplines us, right? A lot of this was so much simpler when I lived in a poor neighborhood in Chile. Our rule in our house was don't have anything in our house that we would be embarrassed to show the neighbors. You know, and the neighbors were the people who lived very poor, little shanties and so on. Now I live in a different
has changed because it's not daily contact with really poor people. And so finding ways to come into contact with people from other kinds of economic realities is one sort of discipline that I think you're kind of pointing to. So thanks for that.
It seems like there's a lot of solutions out there, and we all kind of want to party like it's 1899 and go back to a much simpler time when we weren't so deeply mired in the complexity of today's economy. But as you said before, we need to take this on a case-by-case basis and recognize the particularities of where we live in San Diego. Buying local means fish tacos, like we're a giant city playing on top of a desert. I can't really. I don't have the greatest agricultural selection to choose from. So Stanley Hauerwas is fond of saying, referring back to a modest proposal for peace, that the Christians of the world stop killing each other, as one simple step towards moving towards the abolishment of war. I'm just curious if there's one simple step you could suggest for just Christians across a variety of locales around the country and around the world, different times and places, that would really kind of move us towards a new and different radical economy.
Brewing. Sorry?
Brewing
beer? That's right. Yeah. Oh, gosh. That's an excellent question, and I'm just not really sure how to answer that. It might be don't eat meat. I don't know. I mean, although my family does eat meat, but we buy from an organic family farmer that we have a relationship with. We go out to the farm and we get it. So I'm not sure if that's a kind of that's the one size fits all answer. I mean, reading labels, is something that I do obsessively. That's I think the beginning. I mean, finding out where your stuff is coming from is the beginning. I don't know. I don't have a simple answer. Does anybody want to propose a simple answer to that question?
Focus on
Pope's new encyclical on the plane, which came out just a couple of days ago. And he's kind of dealing with some of these questions as well. And trying to take a sort of middle position where you don't think that that we can't use our God-given, you know, talents to try to cure cancer or something like that. A middle position between that and, on the other hand, these kinds of Frankenstein things. And I'm just not sure that there's a sharp line that can be drawn. You know, I mean, a clone has a soul. If a human being was to be cloned, it would still be seen as a creation of God that has a soul, as regrettable as the cloning process might be. But I'm just not sure there's a real sharp, bright line. What needs to happen is more, I think, kind of stepping back from the abyss and changing the entire way we view creation as not something to be manipulated and dominated, and not something to be escaped, but something to be treasured in that way. But I'm not sure that I have any more specific than that to offer. It's an excellent question.
We're going to end questions there, though. We know Bill will be around, and folks can continue the conversation with him. Our schedule has an indication of the room assignments for all four of our workshops. Both workshops repeat again in the afternoon. The rooms will stay the same. All of the rooms are on the third floor of the Student Center. There are lengthier descriptions of the workshops here as an insert on the right-hand side of your folder. We encourage you to go to both workshops and then to recognize that at 3 o'clock, we'll meet back here for the informal round tables. Kelly, did you need to say any more about that? We do encourage everyone to come back. There's a continuing conversation for each of the workshops at the round tables. Round tables 6, 7, 8, and 9 continue those conversations. Round tables 1 through 5 are conversations about pertinent issues or topics that we would also want to pursue. And the linkier descriptions of the roundtables are on the other side of the description of the workshop. Workshop described on this side, roundtable there. We hope you'll all come back at that time. Brazos has asked me to announce that their display is only open until 9 a.m. tomorrow, so plan your browsing and purchasing with that in mind, 9 a.m. tomorrow. And that's it for logistics. On that note, please join me in thanking Bill for his marvelous... and as you make your way from here to the Student Center, if you want to grab a beverage, they're back here on the table. Cream your coffee quickly, for the line will be long.